And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, spring is in the air, and maybe spring is here to stay this time around. We certainly hope so. And one of the things that, of course, is part of the season of spring is what we do with our gardens and with our landscaping. And the Four Seasons Garden Club has planned a lovely event for the day after tomorrow. That is Thursday, April 4th, 6:30 p.m. at Founders Hall on the campus of Kemper Center. And at the center of Thursday evening's program is a presentation by a woman very well known in the Chicagoland as a leading expert in gardening and landscaping. Her name is Nina Kozial. And she is a feature writer for the Landscape Contractor. She is an adjunct faculty member and writer for the Chicago Botanical Garden. She has written extensively about gardening in a number of different publications, including the Chicago Tribune, Chicagoland Gardening, Old House Journal, and others, and has written a new book called White Gardens, Creating Magnificent Moonlit Spaces. And that is at least primarily what she's going to be talking about with this talk on Thursday night. So this is an event that is free and open to the public, although the folks at the Four Seasons Garden Club would appreciate it if you registered through Eventbrite that you intend to come so they can make sure that they have space and chairs to accommodate everybody. Again, for this visit coming up on Thursday evening, April 4th, in Kemper Center's Founders Hall. And I'm so happy to be able to spend a few minutes today over the phone talking with Nina Kozial about her life in the garden, her life in landscaping, and so I'm appreciative of this opportunity. Nina Kozial, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really pleased and honored to be on your show.
I have really enjoyed visiting your beautiful website, and I want to make sure to begin with where you are from. You are originally from Paris, France, that is, born in Paris, France. Tell us more about your early life and at what point interest in gardening and landscaping and so on began to kind of be part of your life.
Sure. Well, my dad was a military photographer during World War II, and actually his entire life he worked in the Army. And my parents were stationed in France in the 1950s at the Americans had a base there, Shape Headquarters. And so I was born there. One of my brothers was born there. But my mother was from England and really instilled the love of gardening into me. And everything about gardening, everything about watching nature and looking at the clouds and being outdoors was just such an important aspect of our lives. We had four siblings, and we are all very interested in nature. And I'll say the English gardening gene.
Very good. I want you to describe in some detail, if you would, the garden that your grandparents had in Chelmsford, Essex, England. You mentioned briefly in your website biography, and even the very brief description there makes it sound like something truly magnificent and magical. Tell us about this garden and the ways in which it was a tremendous inspiration to you.
Absolutely. So by the time my mother and I had gotten back to England, my grandfather had passed away, but I went several times when I was in my 20s to stay with my grandmother. My grandfather had bought a new home back in the late 30s, early 40s, way at the end of town. He wanted to be as far away as possible from downtown Chelmsford. And so he bought the very last house, which adjoined a huge farm. And those folks didn't have cars. These were all smaller homes, long, narrow lots. But in the, I'll call it the front yard, There was no lawn. There was an ornamental tree and lots of flowers and a hanging basket. And in the back was what they would call crazy paving, a little sidewalk made out of landscape stones that went to the garden shed. And there was a little pond. He was a carpenter. He'd built a pond. There was a greenhouse. There were vegetables. There were cut flowers in a tiny, tiny strip of lawn where they could sit on chairs. And hydrangeas, when I went there in my 20s, I was astonished. Blue hydrangeas that, to me, looked like they were the size of basketballs. And it was just a charming little garden. I just loved it. And I loved the greenhouse. And it was so clever because you didn't just walk straight in. You stepped down. The soil was excavated about a foot, which actually helped warm the vegetables a lot quicker in the spring. It was just it's like visiting Peter Rabbit's garden, I suppose.
I love that. So did you end up pursuing formal study of gardening and, you know, botanical matters, or are you largely self-taught in terms of the expertise, which by this point you very clearly possess?
Well, both. I have a convoluted career. My undergraduate degree was in environmental science and education. So back in the 80s, I was doing a lot of prairie burns, and I thought I would become a naturalist. And that sort of evolved more into ornamental gardening. And it just is just an evolution. The other part of it is self-study. I have always said it's so important to continue learning. And so unless you've got a photographic memory, no one knows everything. So I make a point of every day trying to study something that I'm unfamiliar with. It could be a woodland wildflower or a bird that I haven't seen before. So it's a bit of both, the educational part of it. But if I may, I'll just tell you a quick story how my career started when I was age 7.
Please.
My mother was so astounded that so few people had gardens here when my parents moved from Paris back to Chicago. She told me later she would write home, and she was homesick, and she couldn't understand why didn't Americans have these big gardens like they did in England. So she would grow a lot of flowers in our tiny muffin-sized lot in Chicago. We lived in a bungalow. My father worked at Fifth Army headquarters in the city. And so my mother crammed as many plants as she could in there. And she grew impatiens, which is an annual. So over the winter, when I was 7, I tended this pot of impatiens. And it was going to be my science project, the parts of the flowers. And at that time, these were terracotta pots. So now it's February, and we're having the science fair. I carefully take my pot in a big brown grocery bag and walk 3 blocks to school. And as I'm walking through the door with my books in my bag, I drop the bag, and you could hear all the terracotta smash.
Oh, wow.
And needless to say, I did not win the science project that year. So that's how my career in horticulture began.
Wow. Inauspiciously, we might say, but fortunately, there have been a lot of successes that followed thereafter. That's great.
Well, and that's where my English mother started calling me a klutz.
Well, there you go. There are a lot of us around. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with gardening expert Nina Kozial, who is coming to Kenosha the day after tomorrow on Thursday, April 4th, 6:30 p.m. at Founders Hall on the campus of Kemper Center, and will be giving a talk which at least in large measure will spring out of her beautiful new book called White Gardens. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. So give us some sense, Nina Kozial, of where you have lived geographically. I mean, you are obviously with very, very strong ties to the Chicago area. Is this always where you have lived and worked and gardened, or have you been in other places before that?
In fact, it's the former. We live about 45 miles southwest of Chicago. I lived in the city for quite a number of years and near the lakefront. but I just love the Midwest. And we've traveled a lot, but I love the four seasons. I love traveling to Wisconsin and to Michigan. I love the Great Lakes. And the topography and the nature changes so much as you go further north. And it's just a wonderful area to live in and to experience. I could never live in Florida 12 months of the year because you don't experience the seasons. And the polar vortex. Everyone would miss the polar vortex.
Of course. Yeah, nothing like it. So I'm curious, when you say you lived in Chicago, do you mean Chicago, Chicago? I mean, in the heart of the city? And did you live someplace where you could still engage in gardening? Or was that something that was on hiatus for a while?
Well, a little bit of a hiatus. I had lived in an apartment on the north side of the city in Rogers Park. But I still had some containers on the deck, and I was only a few blocks from the lake. So I took frequent walks along the lake and through the parks, especially when the birds were migrating in the spring. I just thought that was fascinating to watch all the different wildlife that was coming through, spring and fall. But other than that, I had lived near Midway Airport in a couple of different places, and then in 1987, my husband and I bought a house surrounded by Cook County Forest Preserves on all four sides. There's only about 30 homes, older subdivision, and I call it a deer-infested acre because we have a lot of deer coming through. But I use my garden as a giant coloring book, and it's sort of like a little laboratory to try different plants. So I like to keep the green industry in business, so I'm always shopping, and soon the garden centers will be filling up with goodies, so I'm looking forward to that.
Mm. So there are a couple of things for which you are very well known. One of them is as a teacher. And you teach several different classes at the Chicago Botanic Garden, as well as the Morton Arboretum, and maybe other places as well. First of all, when did that begin? And tell us about that, what maybe for you, I don't know, maybe it just felt like the most natural thing in the world. I think for some people that might feel like a leap from being kind of a student of gardening to being the teacher teaching others about gardening.
That's a great question. I love teaching, and it started about 1997. I was doing some landscape design at the time, particularly for older homes. I was fascinated by Midwestern homes from the 1800s into the early 1900s, and a fellow at the Arboretum saw my business card and asked if I'd be interested in teaching a class, and that's actually how it started. And then it quickly took off, and I'm pleased to say I just love helping people so they can get more enjoyment out of their own gardens and to help the environment. And I'm so pleased that there are so many younger landscape professionals coming into the trade, many in their 20s and 30s, that are very interested in helping create diversity among the plants and using different plants, using native plants, and just creating more beautiful places. There's all sorts of teaching. There's online classes, many that are free that gardeners can view. Of course, the library. I love books. I'm not. I don't want to sit at my computer all day looking at a screen. So I have a huge collection of gardening books, including those from the 1800s. I love looking back to see what people were growing back then, especially in the Midwest.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I realized when I first looked at this page of your website, I didn't page down. And so I thought it was a list of four classes, two-hour classes that you teach. And just now, just kind of by accident started paging down, and the list goes on and on and on and on. It looks like there might be two or three dozen different classes that you teach, and it just kind of looking at that list of classes gives us a sense of just how wide and varied and complex this whole world is of gardening. Can I just ask you about a couple of items
sure.
that kind of leapt out at me? For one
yes.
thing, mm-hmm. one of the classes or programs that you do is called Gardens of the 1920s. And
yes.
I think most of us, when we think about the 1920s, if we think about the 1920s, we don't think about gardens. We think about a lot of other things for which that decade
yeah.
is quite famous. Tell us why gardening in the 1920s was distinctive and worthy of, you know, the kind of attention that you apparently give it in this particular presentation.
Yes, the 1920s era, so we're talking about right after World War I, when things were pretty bad in this country in terms of, you know, food supply and the economy. After the war, things greatly picked up, and the range of housing styles and women's magazines, or what they would call now shelter magazines of the period, really focused on all sorts of gardening trends, including ponds and cut flower gardens. And it's just fascinating. And your listeners can look online and just search for home and garden magazines. It could be, you know, 1920, 1924. The illustrations on the covers are absolutely charming. And all the home styles were different. We started to see Sears kit homes. And what was fascinating to me in the Chicago area, when they would deliver these Sears kit homes on the railroads, so they'd have the entire one side of the house was already built. The window box was built into that side of the home. And so when you look at the illustrations from the home builders back in that period, you can see the types of annuals and flowering shrubs and things that were used around these homes. So it's part a look at the residential home styles, the arbors, the fencing that was used, the types of old-fashioned roses and things like that. And, you know, by 1929, when the Depression hit, things were, you know, massively different. But there was this charming period of about 1920 up until the Depression where there was a really big interest in gardening.
Fascinating. And I noticed from this long list of courses that there are other periods in which you focus in a similar sort of fashion. Something else that leapt out at me as a term I've seen and yet don't know anything about is Victory Gardens. Your class is titled Victory Gardens Then and Now. This class looks at the history of war gardens and victory gardens. I have a feeling some of our listeners are acquainted with that term, and there are probably others like me who don't know really exactly what that is. Can you explain what that term refers to?
I'd be happy to. During World War I, when many people don't realize, in 1917 in New York, during World War I, there were riots over food shortages. And the government created this big educational program in calling it War Gardens. There were many posters. Your listeners can look for those online. I'm sure many of them have seen these educational posters put out by the U.S. government to encourage people to grow their own food. And some of these posters are really charming. It's, you know, sow seeds for victory. And they've got all these little vegetables marching off to war with guns over their shoulders. But the whole idea was get people to grow their own food, to help out the food supply. So those were called war gardens during World War I. And then in World War II, they changed the name to Victory Gardens, and there was another big push to encourage people to grow their own food and take the pressure off some of the farms, because many of the farmers and other and men were off to war. And so they really were pushing this big Uncle Sam encourages to grow your own food. And what happens is after both wars, when the economy bounces back, there's a move away from vegetable gardening, sorry to say. You know, when all those, I'll call them the GIs, came back after World War II, they were raising families, and, you know, gardening was not on the radar. That's a leisure activity for many people. And so the Victory Garden sort of disappeared after that. But I'm so thrilled with this, you know, the foodie movement, the interest in cooking and culinary topics, that we're seeing more people, especially after the pandemic, more people starting to grow their own food, even on decks and balconies. There are many things you can grow to use in your kitchen. So I'm glad to see there's a resurgence of that.
It's great to see. And yes, I see you do an entire program just on container gardening and others that involve fruits and vegetables, and one class called Totally Tomatoes, in which apparently you explore all kinds of different varieties of tomatoes and so on. There are several different courses you teach or programs you present in which we see the word artist. There is one called the Arts and Crafts Garden, and there is another class called the Gardener as Artist. And maybe that says a little something about your own aesthetic or how you kind of see the world of gardening. But I wonder if you could just touch on, I think from the look of it, it is these are two very different classes, but the Gardener as Artist and then the Arts and Crafts Garden.
Well, let me talk about the Gardener as Artist first, because I took mechanical drafting in high school a million years ago during the dinosaur era, and I can draw a great stick figure. I would never call myself a watercolor artist or anything like that, but everyone who gardens is an artist, and I try to emphasize that in all of my classes. You know, when you think about it, gardeners work with three dimensions. They work with line and color and space, form and shape, and they don't often consider themselves artists, but they are. They're working in three dimensions, and the thing that they deal with that most, I'll say, watercolorists or oil painters or sculptors work with is that the gardener, that palette comes and goes. It's constantly changing, and I think that's the fun of it. And like I said, that my garden is like a giant coloring book. And so in my containers and around our patio, I like to use a lot of annuals, because then I can change that color palette every year. And so I want all the gardeners who are listening to give themselves a pat on the back. Each and every one of you is an artist, no matter if you do it, you're gardening in a container, a window box, or a giant sweeping suburban garden. The Arts and Crafts Gardens really refers to that period back to about 1900 to 1930 or so, and it looks at really what was an English aesthetic that was, in terms of housing design and garden design, that was brought to this country. And it's a look at the different types of bungalows and arts and crafts style homes, primarily in the Midwest, but I cover other, you know, California had many types of craftsman bungalows, but you see those throughout the Midwest from that period, again, from about 1900 through the early 30s. So two different classes, but the main takeaway here is everyone that's listening, if you plant a peony or a petunia, you are an artist, and I want everyone to think about that and be the artist as you are a gardener.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Nina Koziel, who is coming to Kenosha Thursday evening, April 4th, for a presentation, 6:30 p.m., at Founders Hall on the campus of Kemper Center. This is a free event open to the public, and we're so glad that the Four Seasons Garden Club is making this presentation possible. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be touching on the topic that Nina Koziel is going to be exploring Thursday evening. In addition to being a very busy teacher, you're also a very busy writer. And at the outset of the interview, I listed just some of the publications for which you have written over the years. Tell us how this aspect of your professional life began, and some of the first writing that you did about gardening. I suspect it was a couple of years ago you started doing this.
Well, I will tell you, I had many, many rejection letters. Mm. A friend of mine who is an editor for an association magazine, she and I got together one time, and he had a glass of wine on the patio, and we shared all of our rejection letters and postcards with misspellings. And one day she said to me, why don't you just pick up the phone and call the Tribune's Home and Garden section and see if they'd be interested. And that never dawned on me. That was in 1995. And so I did, and I said, would you be interested in a story on rugosa roses? And they said yes. And after that, it was 22 years of freelancing for them. And the best part about that was all the different gardeners that I was able to interview. That was an eye-opener for me. I have to say, many, if not most, gardeners are quite eccentric. The gardens could have been tiny, urban, suburban, ex-urban, way out in the boonies, but they all had different styles and different mentors, and, you know, many were professionals in the landscape industry. And that foray into visiting their gardens and seeing, it was as much about the person as about the garden, I found fascinating. And even some of these very high-end gardens along Chicago's North Shore, and I'm talking about the 8-acre gardens with three professional gardeners. I thought, unless I win that lotto, I will not have an 8-acre garden. But I could take little vignettes, little planting ideas, container ideas. There was always something I walked away with. Not literally, but in terms of creativity, I got to see how other people do it. And I think that's a tip for your listeners too. When they're on garden walks or house walks or even walking in their neighborhood, take pictures of folks of their gardens or their plantings, especially this spring when so many ornamental shrubs are starting to open. So, it was my career in writing started out with a few bumps in many rejection letters, and then out of the blue, just taking that leap and making the call to the Tribune Home and Garden section editor, it just opened a door that I never dreamt of.
Hmm. Wonderful. Your website also includes a wonderful blog that I would encourage people to explore. And one of the things that it brings to mind just at a glance is that, as you mentioned earlier, you have a real interest not only in things that grow in the ground, but in the things that visit them, the creatures, I mean. Well, maybe you're not a huge fan of the deer that complicate matters, but you clearly have a great love of butterflies and bees and birds and so on, and it sounds like the gardening that you do is done at least in part to create gardens that will be visited by some of these beautiful creatures.
Absolutely. You know, that's part of it. It's not just the spring fury for gardeners. It's not about, I've got to get to the garden center. And I used to do this 30 years ago, or maybe 10 years ago, go to the garden center. We've had a long Midwestern winter and buy everything just to, you know, like I said, it's like crayons. You're buying all these different colors and popping them in the ground. I try to look at the space that we have, this acre, as an inviting home for not just our native insects, but also for the birds that are coming through. And I try to keep track of when the spring peepers, little frogs start calling in the spring, when the first red-winged blackbirds come through, when the first ruby-throated hummingbirds come through. And I plant a lot of annuals, but also many natives. It's quite a mixture, specifically to feed them and to attract them. as well as the butterflies that come through, and not just monarchs, but the swallowtails and many of the tiny skippers. I would encourage all the gardeners listening to take time out, especially the avid gardeners. They never sit down. They sit down for a minute and then see something that needs weeding. I think it's so important to take the time out and walk through the garden, look at what's happening, what might be eating your plants. It could be ladybug larvae. And so rather than get the sprays out right away, look up the insects either on an app on your phone or on the internet, in a book. Don't be in a big hurry to spray insects right away, and take the time to look. You know, get yourself a cup of tea or coffee or a mocktail or a cocktail and get out there and just stroll through your garden and observe. That's, to me, is such a critical part of being outdoors, being in your garden. So, yes, and right now I'm looking, we've got, we still have the juncos. I'm looking at my bird feeders out the window. There are juncos and many downy woodpeckers. We have a pileated woodpecker that comes. There's a nuthatch. I just love watching their antics.
Wonderful.
So it's an important part, an important part of the gardening experience for everyone, not just for me.
Of course. Describe to our listeners as best you can. I mean, this is radio after all, but describe to our listeners the kind of garden, or I should maybe say gardens, that you have right now, and what is most important in terms of what the gardens you are tending right now.
Well, I have a big, since 1987, plants have come and gone, not by my creation necessarily, but they have just either died over the years, older trees that were on the property, and some that just did not do well, some, you know, I lost over winter. But right now, we've got an 80-foot-long border that's about 12 feet deep along our road, and that faces the forest preserves. And that's, on one side, is filled with flowering shrubs, and there's a little stone wall there. And the other side, it's all annuals. And one year, my mother looked out there. I don't remember what month this was, but in her English voice said, you don't have enough color. So my sister and I ran out there with the hose. We laid it on the ground and spray painted a new line. We extended it. And then I took out the grass, extended that border, and I started planting annuals. So in that front border, there's 80 feet long. It's, at that point, it's about 8 feet deep. It's filled with annuals specifically for hummingbirds and butterflies. So that's one area. Mm. And another area is a large shade garden with a big path that goes through. That's a little bit newer, but I have some evergreen trees. One is about 40 feet tall. That was a little evergreen that my nephew, when he was little, got that from McDonald's in a little cup. Huh. And it's towering right now. So there's a lot of these memory plants in there. There's some peonies from my mother's old house in Chicago. But we also have a very large vegetable garden. It was 55 by 22. And that area is in a low spot in the garden, and it's so wet, it was impossible 2 years ago to get in and work. We had so much rain that spring. And my husband used to like to do that garden. And he said, I don't think I want to do this anymore. So one of my landscape friends came over. I bought 6 giant horse troughs from a tractor supply. They're huge.
Wow.
And they built 2 raised beds and put gravel down. So now I don't have to worry about, it's all muddy in April when I want to put the lettuce out. And then I have some pawpaw trees, native pawpaws, and another area with raised beds for other types of smaller vegetables like radishes and spinach and things like that. So it's evolving. It's ever evolving.
Very good. Is this something that the two of you engage in? I think you've mentioned your husband. Or are you the gardener and is he the admirer from afar?
He wishes he was the admirer. He's we've removed a lot of grass over the years, but we still have enough on this acre that he's got a rider mower. And, you know, it's like in fifth speed when he's flying around out there. So he does a lot of the, if I need something cut back with a chainsaw, I could get my hard hat and a pair of safety glasses, but he does that. And a lot of the mowing and things like that outside. But, he enjoys the things like the tomatoes that we harvest and the eggplant and all those sorts of things. And I love to cook. So that's, I just want to mention, there's one of the classes, as you were looking at the list, I have to laugh. One of the most popular classes is the cocktails class, herbal teas and cocktails. It's either oftentimes young couples or groups of women. And, you know, I cover everything from herbal teas, mocktails, where you don't need alcohol, and cocktails, using a lot of different herbs. So it's just a fun class.
Ironically, I mean, as I look at these photographs, there is spectacular color to be enjoyed. And you've made mention of that, I think, more than once about the way in which you view what you do in terms of your garden as, you know, someone who has a, you know, blank slate under which you can paint, painting with flowers and just creating this wonderful cascading array of colors. It's just spectacular to behold. Ironically, your most recent book, in a sense, approaches the matter of color in a completely different way. Tell us about this newest book called White Gardens and maybe a little bit about the genesis of it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, ironically, this was a class, I used to teach a class called Moonlight Gardens, which involves white fragrant flowers, and that was from about 1997 until 2003. And then we had West Nile, and everyone was in a big panic because people were being bit by mosquitoes at night. And so I stopped teaching that. That's 20 years ago. I had an email from a publisher, and I almost missed this email, asking me if I would be interested in working on a book of that topic. And it's so, to me, it was so poignant because this was 2.5 years ago, and my mother was living with us. She was 90. She was about to be 99, and she had just gone into hospice. And so she was here in our house in a hospital bed, but listening to ABBA and the Bee Gees, her favorites. And I was reading gardening books to her, and she was still really good. I mean, she had her 99th birthday here. I was so happy to tell her that I was going to have a book out on the Moonlight Garden. And that was the biggest thing to me. This, again, it sort of fell out of the sky for me. It just, after many years, 20 years ago, I was pitching ideas to book publishers on vegetable gardens. They weren't interested. And this just sort of fell out of the sky. And it was a topic that was near and dear to my heart, and I was so happy I could tell my mother about it before she passed away. Oh. So it was, and I dedicated the book to her.
Fantastic.
So,
explain to our listeners, if they take this book in hand and explore it, what kind of beautiful things are they going to find and see?
Sure. Well, the book covers everything from a bit of the history of moon gardens going back to Japan in the 1800s. So there's a little bit of that to, it's White Gardens and Moonlight Gardens, past and present. So there's some fun images from a Vaughn Seed catalog in Chicago in 1888 and the Ladies' Home Journal in 1896 that look at white flowers and fragrant flowers that can be enjoyed at dusk and beyond. And this is something I think many people don't realize, you know, if you've got all those brilliant colored flowers, purple, pink, orange, those all disappear at dusk. And what really starts to show up at night are white flowers, white structures, fragrance in the garden. And it doesn't matter if it's dark out and you don't have any lights around, there is ambient light in the sky. And so those white flowers show up. And oftentimes, many of them are pollinated at night by moths. So it's just sort of fascinating. And then the rest, the half the book is goes into the types of plants you can use, from perennials and annuals and shrubs and tropicals. So if, you know, folks had questions about what might they use in this area, but I also talk about other features. It's not just the plants. So things like small water features. There are pondless waterfalls, very small features that are self-contained, where you have the gentle sound of the water in the evening. And then there are so many new fire tables that are out that, you know, can be used with a propane burner. So all sorts of things like that. And the structures in the garden, and lighting, some real subtle lighting to enhance different aspects of the garden, like ornamental trees or trellis work. So I'll just call it the whole ball of wax. It's a little, and then there's information about siting plants and amending your soil, that type of thing. So it's, for me, it was an interesting look at really what was a Victorian garden, the white gardens, you know, being outdoors at dusk. I want to go back to the mosquito issue for just a bit. You know, now, since West Nile, it's still around, the mosquitoes are really active right at dusk. And so you could use a repellent on your clothing. But what I like to use as well are these inexpensive battery-operated fans. You could put those on your patio table, by your feet, you know, around your ankles. Mosquitoes can't come to you in the wind. They like a quiet, still evening to come and seek out their prey. So if you've got these small fans in the area, battery operated, they're inexpensive. You can put them around your feet and on the tables or near your chairs, and that should eliminate the mosquito problem as well.
So your talk in Kenosha Thursday evening will be drawn largely from this new book, correct?
I mean, that's right, right. You know, the other thing I wanted to mention, after the pandemic, when, you know, a lot of people were at home, they were enjoying their gardens, you could not find a bag of potting soil or a hose at the big box store, everybody was running out and gardening. And now that people are back to work, you know, we're either working from home or working in an office or a service industry, and oftentimes we don't get to be outdoors until later. And so I think that's something gardeners need to think about. How can you enjoy your garden, not just during the day or on, let's say, the weekends, but at dusk and beyond, especially in the summer when our evenings, you know, the sunlight is still, the light in the sky is still present until about 9 p.m. That's the time to enjoy your garden.
Good point. So as you look back over the many years that you have been an avid gardener, do you find that your relationship to your gardens and to the vocation of gardening has changed? I mean, maybe another way to ask that is, are you gardening now with a different purpose in mind, or does it give you maybe a kind of a different kind of pleasure now than it did, say, 20 years ago? Or by and large, does it still feel exactly the same? And is it just some of the lovely, wonderful specifics that have changed?
It is. That's a great question, a wonderful question, and that's something I have to ponder. The one thing that's changed are my knees and my back in the past 20 years. So although I still kneel down to do a lot of things like that, digging, it's not that I'm trying to make my garden lower maintenance. I think my husband has said, you're making this higher maintenance. But I am gardening more for specific butterflies to bring those in. And I'm exploring new plants, new cultivars. And the one thing that I'm kind of spending more time on right now is researching native plants in what are called nativars or cultivars of native plants, where plant breeders are taking, let's say, our native milkweeds, and they might be hybridizing them or selecting them for better qualities, like bigger flowers, longer flowers. I'm researching this with a friend to see what studies have been done and how these new plants might affect our native bees and so on. There's some controversy about this, and so that for me is a big thing, our native plants and native cultivars. And but I'll still be buying a lot of plants this spring. So in that respect, my gardening hasn't changed. My gardening habits haven't changed in terms of planting. It's just it's a great hobby. It's my husband calls it our outdoor health club. So it's in, you know, you're outdoors. You get yourself away from those screens and get outside.
Absolutely. Great advice. Well, I know a lot of people are very excited about the talk you're going to be giving in Kenosha. We want to remind everyone that talk is coming up Thursday evening, April 4th, 6:30 p.m. in Founders Hall at Kemper Center, right there on the lakefront of Kenosha. And this is an event that is free and open to the public. Although the good folks at the Four Seasons Garden Club who are sponsoring this would appreciate it if you would register for the event at Eventbrite so they can be sure to be able to accommodate everyone who comes. And we do also want to remind everyone that Nina Koziel's newest book is titled White Gardens, Creating Magnificent Moonlit Spaces. Nina Koziel, I have thoroughly enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about your fascinating life and career as a gardener, and it makes me not only want to get outside, it makes me want to visit the Chicago Botanical Gardens and other places where spectacular, wonderful things can be viewed. Thank you so much for taking the time to be part of this, and we look forward to your talk coming up on April 4th.
Thank you. It was a pleasure and an honor to be on your show. Thank you. Happy spring.